I would ask for you to think about what the St. Francis Health System and the people that work there mean to our community, what they mean to you and your family and your neighbors, the heroes who protect you. Think about what they mean to you and think about in your own way what you can do to show your support for them in the midst of this tragedy.
The mayor of Tulsa, Oklahoma, G.T. Bynum, yesterday, after a gunman killed four people at a hospital complex, 10 others were injured. Among the dead, two doctors, one of whom performed back surgery on the gunman. Police officials described the scene as chaotic, with hundreds of patients and staff frantically trying to get out of the building. The gunman had just purchased an AR-15 hours before the attack. He was found dead at the scene from a self-inflicted wound. Well, this is just the latest mass shooting after Buffalo and Uvalde. We live in a gun culture. There are more guns than people here in the United States. And a lot of the American mythology of grit, independence, and frontier justice involves a gun. Much of that mythology comes from what we watch on film, TV, and video games. We're going to talk about the link between on and off-screen gun violence now with Dan Romer, Research Director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so a lot of people question whether there is an overt link. Is it possible to even prove such a thing exists between gun violence we see on screens and gun violence then practiced in public?
Well, we've tried to study the link by looking at how much gun violence there is in movies. We've been looking at PG-13 movies in particular, which are widely available and have been growing in violence ever since they were that category was created, that rating category. And on TV, we've been looking at TV-14, which is also widely available. There's no restriction that parents might, you know, impose. And there as well, the amount of violence has gone up, and the proportion of the violence that's committed with firearms has gone up. So then we relate that to what's been going on in the real world. And if you look especially at young people, ages 15 to 24, the proportion of homicides that they have experienced committed with a firearm has gone up since 2000, up to 2018 is what the last year we tracked it. So there is, in our mind, a relationship there.
Yeah, but it must be very difficult unless the gunman specifically says, I watched X and X made me want to pick up a gun and shoot up the school, to actually know if that is one of the causes. The same period that you talk about also coincides with the end of the assault weapons ban. So that could also be one of the main factors as well, right?
Well, what we're thinking is that the fact that you can get assault weapons and they are shown prominently in entertainment, that works together, because other countries have the same entertainment that we have, but they don't have a gun violence problem like we have, and that's because you cannot get the kinds of military-style weapons that anyone can buy here, as long as they're 18 and don't have a record, a criminal record. They can walk into a store and buy an AR-15 or a Glock. These are weapons that can shoot many, many rounds very quickly. And those are the kinds of weapons that are used in these kinds of events.
So Hollywood likes to say there is no connection, right? That this is fantasy, that most people who watch these movies don't go out and commit an act of violence. And yet at the same time, we've banned cigarette advertising on television and in movies, right?
Yeah. And the use of cigarettes went down. Now, one thing we had in the case of cigarettes was we had better evidence. So we had trials, you know, like observational studies where we asked young people to tell us, have you seen a movie with someone smoking? And we were able to show that the young people who said that were more likely to start smoking. We haven't done that kind of research with movies and television. Partly because there's not enough money, you know, being spent on this kind of problem. But if there were, and one did that kind of study, I think one would find that the young people who watch more movies with guns are at greater risk of getting a gun and then potentially, using one.
Now, you talked about the rating system as possibly contributing to this, the PG-13 and TV-14 rating system. What do you mean by that? How does that actually normalize violence? Because it's meant to keep kids away from the most offensive material.
What's happened with the PG-13 rating is Hollywood has figured out a way to sanitize the violence so that it meets that rating and parents don't feel upset about letting their kids watch it. And in fact, a lot of the violence tends to be seen as virtuous. And we've done studies that show that the parents who see a lot of the gun violence that's in movies and on television, they think is just, people defending themselves or their family or friends. And that's a virtuous way to use a gun. So, they sanitize it. So you don't have any unpleasant experience of watching it. You don't see blood. You don't see any real pain. And so, it's very easy to watch.
So what do you think Hollywood should do?
Well, I think they should stop allowing the industry to place their weapons in their movies and television shows. And even if they're not directly placing them there, they have agents who work with the movie industry, to be sure that they have the right kind of weapon. The Economist magazine has detailed all of this and looked at the changes in the number of appearances of all the different guns, including the automatic rifles, the Glocks. All of these military-style weapons are featured very, very often in Hollywood movies and on television.
Hmm. But that's because the storylines revolve around these kinds of activities, right? These kind of shoot 'em up movies, thrillers, westerns, what have you. That's really popular.
It is, and it's a prop. The gun is a prop, and if Hollywood wanted to, they could, just like cigarettes were a prop, if they wanted to, they could cut down on the amount of gun use in their programming. It's gone up. There's no reason why it needed to go up. And they can still show violence without showing people shooting each other if they wanted to.
Do you think that now is the time when filmmakers and everyone else in Hollywood might reconsider how they glorify violence, given what's happened lately?
Yes, I wish they would.
I
don't think that, if you look at what's going on in terms of strategies to reduce the gun violence, there's two that are not talked about very much. One is make it illegal to have these weapons and prevent the promotion of them. And the people who support gun rights will say, these strategies are just impeding my ability to exercise my Second Amendment rights. And there's a part of that is true. I mean, they're not going to stop the gun violence that we see because people can get these weapons unless they have a criminal record. And even that doesn't seem to prevent them from getting these weapons because there's such an informal market.
But on the other side, you have liberals who are for gun control saying Hollywood, there's no connection between what we see on screen and what we see in real life.
Liberals don't want to go there because they think it's letting the use of guns off the hook. It's sort of like putting the blame on Hollywood. Well, Hollywood is part of the problem, and the other half of the problem is the guns. So I think that's why a lot of liberals don't want to go after the blatant promotion of guns in the entertainment industry.
Dan Romer is research director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
Guns and the culture of violence are also glamorized in a lot of rap songs. Rap lyrics are being used in a sprawling criminal indictment of Atlanta rapper Young Thug and 27 others for racketeering. DA Fannie Willis says Young Thug, whose real name is Jeffrey Lamar Williams, co-founded a record label that operated like a street gang, whose members committed murders, shootings, carjackings, and other violent crimes over the span of a decade. The DA says a lot of the proof is in the rap lyrics Young Thug and the other rappers wrote, like in this line from the song Just How It Is.
Ooh, ooh. I done did the robbing, I done did the jacking, now I'm full rapping. I put on my brothers, I put on my, had to wear the dress, cause I had a stick.
Well, this isn't the first time prosecutors have used rap lyrics to support criminal charges. It's been happening since the 1990s. But New York lawmakers are trying to put a stop to it with a bill that would limit prosecutors' ability to use song lyrics as evidence of a crime. It passed the state Senate last month and is awaiting a vote in the state assembly. Joining us to talk about this, the bigger issue of using lyrics as evidence, is Jack Lerner. He's a law professor at UC Irvine and co-author of the book Rap on Trial, A Legal Guide for Attorneys. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so how did prosecutors decide to begin using rap lyrics in court back in the 90s?
Well, I'm not sure how it originally began, but it quickly became a standard, almost standard tool for prosecutors. You know, look for rap lyrics or other things that that might be able to paint the defendant in a bad light or make the defendant look bad or inflame the jury. And as almost 20 years ago, a local district attorney actually authored a guide to prosecuting rap cases where he said, we want to show that, you know, look for rap lyrics, look for photos or whatever, something to show the true character of the person. We want to show them as a thug, not as, as, you know, a whole person. And this was actually put into a printed manual. And the problem with that is that rules of evidence say you can't use character or propensity evidence to do that. But what we've seen is that prosecutors have figured out that they can use rap lyrics that don't represent what the person, the whole person. They don't necessarily have anything to do with the crime, but they can do that to take a shortcut and essentially make an end run around the rule that you can't use character or propensity evidence to obtain a conviction.
But what if there is more direct evidence in the lyrics, a confession, if you will?
So sometimes people do talk about things that they've actually done. That is true, right? And there's actually a famous case of a defendant in Los Angeles who committed a murder and tattooed the murder on an image of the store where the murder took place on his stomach. And not surprisingly, he went to jail. But there are many other examples where people talk about drug dealing, they talk about gangs in their area, and it's completely fantastical compared to their actual life. And 50 Cent, a famous rapper, actually talks about this in his autobiography. You know, he had a song about marijuana usage that came out in, I think, 2004. And he has never used marijuana. He didn't use it then. He doesn't use it now. But he put that song out because, as he said, songs like that were selling 500,000 copies with that content. And so we see it's ubiquitous that people talk about criminal behavior, they talk about activity in their neighborhood, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're actually doing that. And that doesn't mean that that activity has anything to do with the crime that they're actually being charged with.
And is this primarily something that is used with rap music? Are there any other kinds of music that are being used in court?
It's something that's exclusively used with rap music. You know, there, if you look at country music, there are songs about all kinds of illegal behavior, about murder, and that goes back generations in country music. But you don't see prosecutors targeting people based on their country music lyrics. And there's actually a whole body of social science research that shows this as well. Starting in the 1990s, researchers said, okay, we're going to take a folk song about an outlaw who shot somebody because he was feeling low, and we're going to present these lyrics from a folk song sung by white folk singers to subjects that, you know, they're random subjects that are kind of supposed to mirror the jury pool. And they said, do you think this person did it? This is a folk song. And the subject said, no, it's a folk song. It's his art. And they said, what about country? No, it's his art. What about rap music? And as soon as the term rap music came in, subjects found the lyrics to be more offensive, more literal, and that the defendant was more likely to commit crime. So these researchers have posited, and I think it's quite plausible, that what's going on is either a bias against rap music as a genre, or anti-Black bias.
Right. So Johnny Cash wasn't arrested for singing that he would shoot a man in Reno, as an example.
Right. Or that he shot a man in Reno just to watch him
that
die.
He shot. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And Eric Clapton wasn't arrested for singing the Bob Marley song, I Shot the Sheriff. And, you know, there were some rock performers that were targeted back in the 1960s and the 1970s. And that in some ways that mirrors what's going on now, because the music is subversive. It's calculated to be shocking, to be more extreme. And in rap music, there's a long culture that goes back again generations, much further than rap music, about authenticity, about keeping it real. Mm-hmm. And projecting authenticity helps people sell records and helps people get more credibility. But that doesn't mean that it's actually what's going on. And prosecutors have said, oh, well, let's take this culture of authenticity and let's weaponize it to get easy convictions that make it easier that can help us avoid having to actually prove the case.
Well, let's look at this case against Young Thug. It's an 88-page racketeering indictment, a sprawling indictment. How central are the lyrics to their case?
Well, in the case of Jeffrey Williams, who goes by Young Thug professionally, there's no connection between any of the crimes committed other than his rap music. So most of the time, someone would say, oh, well, you're accused of murder or you're accused of robbery, and here's a bunch of rap lyrics that talk about how you're a violent person. And so courts will say, okay, well, that shows intent or motive, or that shows, sometimes courts have even said that shows general knowledge of the crime. So that's problematic because it's really tenuously connected to the elements of the crime, to the evidence of the crime. And that's how most of rap lyrics that get into the courtroom are brought in, or maybe they say these tie the person to a gang. Here, there's no underlying crime connected to this racketeering conspiracy. He's accused of renting a car that was used by someone else in a robbery. He's accused of a weapons charge, and I believe there was one other charge, but those charges themselves, those accusations, don't have any connection to this supposed gang. And then there's all these lyrics where he talks about YSL and he talks about what's going on. So to me, this is an escalation, and to other people who watch this issue, this is a real escalation, because it's not tying his, you know, the lyrics aren't confessions of a crime. They're saying it's guilt by association because of your lyrics. And your lyrics essentially are the hook by which we can now charge you with, you know, dozens of other crimes that all these other people are committing. But the allegations in the indictment don't say anything about, they don't say he hangs out with them, does this or that. It's just rap lyrics and then a few unrelated charges.
Jack Lerner is a law professor at UC Irvine and co-author of the book Rap on Trial, A Legal Guide for Attorneys. Jack, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, why some people who take the COVID antiviral medicine Paxlovid are experiencing rebound cases. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The antiviral drug Paxlovid has been hailed as a major breakthrough in the fight against COVID. If prescribed quickly after someone is infected, it can keep that person from ending up in the hospital or even dying. But the CDC warned this week that some people who take Paxlovid develop rebound COVID symptoms a few days after they recover. The agency says Paxlovid is still a beneficial drug. Some doctors, though, say they are reconsidering whether to prescribe it to all of their patients. Dr. Kalpana Gupta is the chief of infectious diseases at VA Boston Healthcare Systems, and she co-authored a paper that looked into COVID rebound infections. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much.
Okay, well, first, how is this supposed to work, Paxlovid? I know you're supposed to take it really soon after you experience symptoms?
Yeah, so Paxlovid is an antiviral agent. It works by inhibiting replication of SARS-CoV-2, and by blocking replication, it reduces the symptoms and have been very effective in studies in reducing hospitalization and death in patients who take Paxlovid.
And how long are you supposed to take it?
You take it for 5 days. That's how it has been authorized by the FDA, and that's what was studied by the manufacturer Pfizer.
And is it for anyone who experiences symptoms, or do people have to be at high risk?
So the initial studies were done in patients who had a high risk of progression of disease that would require either hospitalization or potentially progress even to death. Those are criteria that have been well outlined by the CDC and essentially include practically any comorbidity, certainly include an immunocompromise and a variety of other conditions. So currently, Paxlovid is indicated for most people in the outpatient setting who have mild to moderate symptoms, are within 5 days of the onset of those symptoms, don't have an exclusion, which is kind of some drug interactions, or severe renal or liver disease. So there are some basically check boxes to decide if your patient is eligible for Paxlovid, but many, many patients out there are eligible. And again, overall, the drug's been very effective in reducing progression of COVID-19.
Okay, so let's talk about this rebound situation the CDC is warning about. What did you discover in your research?
Well, it started really with one case, and this was a patient who also happens to be a scientist and essentially took Paxlovid for a case of acute COVID-19 infection and was testing himself, and that's the patient we describe in our paper, did very well, had resolution of symptoms, and his test became negative while taking the Paxlovid, but then a few days later had essentially a relapse of symptoms and was smart enough to say, well, let me see what's going on here, and did a COVID-19 at-home test and found that he was positive. And so from there, we were able to get more information and actually get the samples and sequence the virus. In the meantime, the word was getting out that there was this syndrome of relapse, and then many other people started to report that they were having similar symptoms. And in fact, in our paper now, we have a case series of over 10 people with well-documented cases of getting better with the Paxlovid, which is, you know, what it's intended to do, and then having a rebound of symptoms somewhere between 2 to 8 days after stopping their treatment.
And are the rebound symptoms bad?
For the most part, the rebound symptoms have been either milder or similar to the initial symptoms of COVID-19 infection in each of the individuals. And there's been no reports of severe illness as part of that rebound syndrome. And that's why it's very important for people to understand that Paxlovid is still a very important therapeutic for outpatients who meet the criteria because it still is doing what it was supposed to do, which is keep people from progressing to severe disease.
But what is the idea or what is the hypothesis as to why this is happening? Did the Paxlovid just mask the symptoms and then when the treatment stopped, they just resurfaced again?
Yeah, so that's sort of the million-dollar question, and it's very interesting to think about. There's a couple of important points. Number one, we know that when people take Paxlovid, in fact, it's not only that their symptoms get better, but in fact, the virus load goes way down, so the tests become negative, including PCR tests, which, as you know, are very sensitive to detect the virus. So overall, it's very effective. The reason for the rebound could be related either to the fact that the supposition is that there may be an immune response that's not fully in effect by the time the Paxlovid five-day course is finished. And so there's a small rebound of viral load, which we demonstrated that in fact, that viral load does come back. You can find a positive test along with those symptoms. So that's a possibility. The one thing we have been able to exclude so far, at least in our small case series, and others have reported this as well, is it does not look like it's a mutation or something, a new virus that's causing this rebound. So that's all very good news. And the rebound, when it does occur, is relatively mild, and the CDC put out some very useful guidance in terms of how to manage that.
But given what you are learning, would you now not recommend taking Paxlovid if you are an otherwise healthy person who is not at risk of developing severe symptoms or hospitalization?
Well, that's a tough question because that group of patients is not actually officially eligible for Paxlovid. Paxlovid is indicated by the FDA authorization for people who have mild to moderate symptoms and are at risk for progression. But in that category, absolutely the recommendation is still to use this agent. It is, again, with the NIH guidelines, the number one recommended agent, also with the CDC, a recommended agent in their health advisory. So it absolutely is doing the work it was intended to do. This rebound phenomenon, although we're recognizing it with Paxlovid, there is some discussion as to whether rebound may also happen in other patients, even if they don't get Paxlovid. In fact, Pfizer did report that 1-2% of their patients in their study, regardless of whether they were receiving Paxlovid or not, had a rebound syndrome. So it may occur even in other people who aren't getting Paxlovid. It certainly is not a reason not to use the drug if you have a patient who's eligible for it. So I think that's very important to understand and important for providers and the public to realize that there is something out there that's very helpful in terms of staying out of the hospital and avoiding progression of disease.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
That's Dr. Cal Gupta, Chief of Infectious Diseases and Associate Chief of Staff at VA Boston Healthcare Systems. Coming up, we will have your weekend movie reviews.
There's a little bit of historical name dropping going on, like to the point where, oh, it's T.E. Lawrence. You know, like it kind of drops from the sky and it seems like, okay, yes, we get it. He knew famous people.
Alonzo Duralde and Dave White, the husbands, they are here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Thursday, so it's time to talk about new movies for your weekend. And lucky for us, we have Alonzo Duralde and Dave White. They are film critics for The Wrap and co-hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Welcome.
Hello there.
Hello.
Hello. Wow, we have a lot of gay on the show today, so I'm very excited.
It's the beginning of June, Madeline. Pace yourself.
That's right. I know. Gay Pride and all that. All right. First up, Fire Island. It stars Joel Kim Booster, Bowen Yang, and Margaret Cho.
Promise me you'll try to have a good time.
Do not let these people think that they are better than us.
Never mind.
You think they're so superior than everybody else.
I don't think I'm better than you.
You think that if you're vulnerable for 1 second, it's going to come crashing down.
Oh, my God.
Okay, Alonzo, Joel Kim Booster wrote the script. Sounds like a comedy.
Yes, very much so. And, you know, they very intentionally name drop Jane Austen in about the first 30 seconds or so, which lets you know what you're in for. This is a very gay rom-com set on the very gay tourist resort of Fire Island off the coast of Manhattan. But it is very much a Jane Austen type of story. Joel Kim Booster plays a guy who is not into relationships. He just likes to have sex, but he wants to get his best friend, played by Bowen Yang, some action while they're in Fire Island, even though his friend is really more looking for the Hearts and Flowers happy ending. And this puts them in contact with, and sometimes in conflict with, another group of people on the island who are much richer and whiter than they are. So you get that whole sort of like Jane Austen, you know, class difference with a little bit of race thrown in, but also some very, you know, outrageous sexual humor, and ultimately some really deep friendship stuff along the way as well.
I can't imagine Mr. Darcy on Fire Island, but hey, who knows?
If he could rock a Speedo, you know.
He rocked a white shirt coming out of that lake. But anyway, I digress. Dave, what did you think?
You know, it's sweet and heartfelt in ways that I personally normally don't have room in my heart of stone, but that I've responded to here because I'm, you know, it's June, it's Pride Month. I'm about my community, you know, as much as the next queer person. I'm glad that this film exists. I think a lot of people who are not queer, who don't see a lot of queer narratives, they might think that we are a monolithic community. We are not, neither is our film culture. The representation at play here is refreshing and welcome in ways that we quite often just haven't seen. I think Andrew Ahn, as a filmmaker, he likes to go deep with human relationships in a way that's always appealing and always intuitive. I especially like the Jane Austenisms that are taking place here. You know, in Pride and Prejudice, you've got a young woman who's, you know, she has less money, fewer prospects, and so she's sort of wondering what her life is going to be. And that is analogous to this film as well. And that they figure out a way for characters to write letters to each other.
Aww.
And have them delivered, so you know, nice. Like four houses down. It's very smart, very fun. I'm very pleased with what I have been given with Fire Island. Am I ever going to Fire Island? I am not. But I'm happy to watch a movie about it.
Okay, Fire Island streaming on Hulu beginning tomorrow. Next up, a horror sci-fi film written and directed by David Cronenberg. It's called Crimes of the Future. It stars Viggo Mortensen, Lea Seydoux, and Kristen Stewart.
Surgery is the new sex.
I don't like what's happening with the body. In particular, what's happening with my body. Which is why I keep cutting it up. What do you think they'd find inside it?
Outer space.
Whoops. Sorry.
All right, Dave, this trailer is Cronenberg creepy all the way. Tell us about this movie. What's it about?
It is the future and everyone is upset. And there are a couple of performance artists. They are a couple. Their performance involves Saul growing new organs in his body and having them removed surgically by caprice on stage. And this is something that people can just do now. They grow new organs in the future, things that people have never seen before. Meanwhile, there's an agency that is investigating people who grow new organs.
The National Organ Registry.
Yes. And you get the sense that they are less of an official body than a fan club because they are following the activities of Saul and Caprice very carefully in a... Kristen Stewart's performance in this movie is a thing of beauty. She is quivering in every moment in her engagement with the artists in a way that suggests, I have no idea why I'm here other than I really like your work. You know, there is also a plastic eating cult on the side doing their own strange business. And it all comes to a head in a final sequence that involves an autopsy. This is not a film for everybody.
I'm already feeling a little nauseous. Alonzo, what did you think?
You know, I think that Cronenberg has done this movie before in a lot of ways, but nobody else does movies the way Cronenberg does. So I would rather a rehash from him than the best idea from someone who is utterly untalented and has nothing to say. But, you know, this movie calls up a lot of films from the past to very specific points. Even there's a subplot here about a beauty pageant for most perfectly shaped organs. And that's a joke in Dead Ringers.
Yeah.
That sort of manifests here. But yeah, Dave's right. It is, on the one hand, kind of a satire of the art world and what is expected of artists and how audiences respond to their stuff. But I don't know. I admire it. I think it's beautifully crafted. I maybe will disagree with you on Kristen Stewart's performance. I felt like it's one of the few times that I could catch her acting, which I don't think you usually can. But you know, this does kind of feel like a greatest hits album, but they're good hits.
They're great hits. And we're all ingesting lots of microplastics now anyway, so it's very relevant.
Okay, why not? Crimes of the Future in theaters beginning today. Next up, a period drama directed by Terrence Davies. It's called Benediction.
I've had some sort of breakdown. Your lot is with the ghosts of soldiers dead, and I am in the field where men must fight.
Your duty lies in obeying orders.
In the face of such slaughter, one cannot simply order one's conscience. Good morning, Doctor.
We have a house magazine. I'm sure it would welcome a contribution.
Then I'll try to write something light and amusing.
There's no need to go that far.
All right, Dave, this is about a World War I soldier who returns from the front. He becomes an outspoken critic of the war. He's a poet. Tell us more about this.
Yes, in a way, this is a biopic because Siegfried Sassoon was a well-known poet in England in the 20th century. He wrote a lot about the horrors of World War I that he experienced. He was also gay, and his life was a series of relationships that gave him, you know, little satisfaction until eventually he kind of retreated into a sort of conformity. And it is a gorgeous looking period drama that is routinely infused with Sassoon's poetry, punctuated by archival newsreel footage from the war itself. Davies is that kind of filmmaker. He's developed his own style over the years. Other media often makes appearances in his film, whether it's clips from other films, like in The Long Day Closes, or here, you know, with music and singing and poetry. And he does this in a very precisely controlled way that allows him to maintain very often a kind of hushed tone. He is, I'd say, almost to the point of cliche, not afraid of silences. And I love him for that. This is a movie about a man who digs very deeply into himself and into life, but he can't find what he wants. He can't find the comfort that he seeks, that we all seek. Therefore, it's, you know, it's a deeply melancholy film, but a beautiful one.
All right, Alonso, what did you think?
You know, it's gorgeous. If you're a fan of films like Morris or the miniseries Brideshead Revisited, and you love a, you know, closeted aristocratic fop from the early 20th century, you know, there's a lot of that action in this movie. But at the same time, it ties it very directly to the fact that the Oscar Wilde trial hadn't been that far in the past. Like Robbie Ross, who was an intimate of Wilde's, is also a good friend of Sassoon's. And so it kind of gives you that context of history. Biopic filmmakers should be forced to watch this movie as a way to figure out how to jump around in time and make it smooth and make it relevant and, you know, always sort of let the audience know what's going on. So we go back and forth with Sassoon over the course of his life, and it's handled in a really brilliant way. The performances are great. There's a little bit of historical name dropping going on. Like, I had Wikipedia open while I was watching my screener link because, you know, I knew who Ivor Novello was, but I had to look up, you know, Stephen Tennant. There's a lot of, you know, to the point where, oh, it's T.E. Lawrence, you know, like it kind of drops from the sky and it seems like, okay, yes, we get it. He knew famous people. But yeah, this is a gorgeous film. And, you know, Davis is a gay filmmaker, and I think this is his most sort of centrally gay film. You know, he's dealt with, you know, the life of Emily Dickinson and his own past, you know, his childhood in films. But this is very much a front and center kind of queer narrative.
Yeah, this is my kind of pride movie, a sad one.
So Terrence Davies is not going to Fire Island either.
Hey, if he wants to, I'm sure he would have poetry readings at Tea Dance and it would be great.
And then he would sit down with a cup of tea, which is also my Pride Month activity.
And that is your cup of tea. Benediction is in theaters beginning today. Finally, Cane Fire, a documentary that examines the history of the Hawaiian island of Kauai.
The place has a complicated history, and there are a lot of stories that haven't been told. Our existence threatens their existence.
When I was 7 years old, my dad told me before he died, dime a dozen. They hire you and they can fire you. They used us.
All right, Alonso, the trailer looks interesting. It looks like a mix of reality and fantasy as captured in Hollywood. What is this movie's point?
So, yeah, the director, Anthony Banwa Simon, it's on the one hand a personal film. His great-grandfather was an extra in a now-lost silent film by Lois Weber called Cane Fire. And in looking back at his own family history and at the history of Kauai, this is basically a story about colonization, both the literal kind in which, you know, sugar and pineapple interests basically took over the island, and then the United States annexes Hawaii for its military use, but also, you know, as a tourist site and for its resources. But then later also the kind of cultural colonization of Hollywood, where movies and TV shows come and film there. And it's all about white people and their problems and their vacations with, you know, the indigenous population sort of shoved in the background for local color. And so, you know, it's taking on a lot. It's looking at both this kind of history of exploitation and also how the state has been portrayed in the media. And I think it wraps its arms around it. And it's a stirring film about how large corporate interests have kind of come in and taken over this space, and the people who are from there and live there and you know, do the hard work there are always kind of pushed aside.
Dave, what did you think of Cane Fire?
It's a really eye-opening film for someone like myself who has grown up, you know, simply accepting the narrative that we've all been sold by the official storytellers. Now, I think that the tendency on the part of potential viewers for a documentary like this is to think, oh, this sounds like homework. You know, it's about colonialism, it's about exploitation. But the beauty of a film like this that really works is that its purpose is, yes, to teach you something, but it does so with such an engaging sense of style that works on your brain and your heart. You cannot walk away from this film feeling nothing for the trouble that's been inflicted on Hawaii. And if you're the kind of person for whom movies are important, it's the kind of documentary that will prompt you to read films set in Hawaii in a much different light than perhaps you've done before. It's well worth seeing. Highly recommended.
Okay, Cane Fire, which is playing at the Lumiere Cinema at the Music Hall in Beverly Hills tomorrow through June 9th. Alonzo Duralde, Dave White, film critics for The Wrap and hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here to tell you where to get the best matcha. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lentil?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom, flames.
Bam, that's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Well, on Instagram, you have probably seen a bright green latte. Yes. Matcha. It is everywhere on your social media. Matcha is a colorful powder that can be found in hot drinks, cookies, even soft serve ice cream. We're going to talk about this now with Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Hi there.
Hi.
What exactly is matcha?
So it's a green tea that's grown and treated differently than other green teas. Most green tea is grown in full sun and rolled after it's picked, before it gets dried, whereas matcha is a shade-grown green tea. The leaves aren't rolled, but they're dried flat. Then they're deveined, stemmed, and powdered. So also when you're drinking it, you're not drinking an infusion of leaves that you're straining out. You're ingesting the leaf itself, which is why it's much healthier.
And greener.
Oh, so green. The leaves have extra high chlorophyll content, and then the shade, growing it in the shade, ups the production of L-theanine. It's an amino acid that creates the calm yet alert effect of these teas, and It's about 5 times stronger in matcha than other green teas.
Oh, wow. And the taste?
So the flavor profile is very umami with grassy and bitter notes. If you've ever had a shot of wheatgrass, it has some things in common, but how strong the flavors are depends on the blend. And there are a lot of different kinds of blends on matcha-focused websites, and I have several for you on our website.
All right. And so it has graduated from the humble hot drink into all sorts of things, like baking. So how do you use it in baking?
Well, I wouldn't say humble. I mean, I think the thing that matcha is most known for is the Japanese highly ritualized tea ceremony, which is made with matcha being whisked in the bowl. And there are a few places in LA where you can, where you used to be able to enjoy the tea ceremony. I don't know if many of them are still doing that since COVID, but one place that was doing it was Steep downtown. And so, yes, as Instagram sort of fell in love with the color, it morphed and the powder became just another way to play with color in beverages and foods.
And have you baked with it?
Yeah, I mean, baking with it is so easy because you're just adding a powder. Most cookie recipes, you use about 2.5 tablespoons. To get the really super green color, you have to splash out for the ceremonial tea grade, which gives you an end result that's much greener. The culinary grade, which is less expensive, can sometimes turn brown in the heat of the oven if you don't use a lot. And then if you use too much, you won't like the flavor profile. Unless you really love that super earthy taste.
So you can get a matcha hot drink anywhere, like at Starbucks these days, but there must be really good places for it. As you mentioned, this is part of a ancient Japanese tea ceremony, so they have probably perfected how to make it delicious. So where can we go in town to get a delicious cup of matcha?
Well, there are matcha specialists like Tea Master Matcha and Midori Matcha Cafe, both in Little Tokyo. But for really great matcha lattes, I would also just look for places that do everything to a high standard, including the coffees they make. So high-end coffee places like Verve come to mind. Republique makes a beautiful one. Anywhere that has it on the menu that is also making beautiful coffees will make a really fantastic matcha latte.
Okay. And then you can get ice cream. You can get matcha
ice cream.
Oh, my
goodness.
Right?
It's just endless. I mean, if you want to explore, I have a list of how you can explore through town with matcha. Lady M, which is well known for its cakes that are made out of layers of crepes and frosting, have a green tea cake, which is a celebration of green tea and matcha. The West Side Bakery Artelise makes matcha cookies. And if you're hankering for pancakes, you went at breakfast and one of you wants to try a major ode to matcha, you can go to BB's in Burbank, which makes something they call the Green Tea Monster, which is infused pancakes and matcha mascarpone. And for a real treat, Gelateria Uli is now making green tea matcha gelato with chocolate waffle bits.
Wow.
And I have a recipe that I'm sharing from one of my favorite Japanese online cooking websites. It's a recipe for matcha shortbread cookies with white chocolate bits.
Mm, that sounds so good. Yum. All right. So does that get rid of the bitterness when you make it into a cookie?
You know, even some spices have a bitter side. I mean, bitterness is part of a balanced flavor profile. So I think it's really a matter of taste, that once you start baking with it, you just follow the recipe exactly as it is. And then if it's a bit too much for you, you can just dial it back. But really, it's just, I mean, I've seen gorgeous flourless chocolate cakes with just a shimmering mirror ganache surface with, matcha dusted over the top that just looks fabulous. And so there's ways to use it that offset the bitterness if that is not your favorite flavor profile.
Okay, sounds delish. What is on Good Food this week?
On Good Food this week, I met up with cultural critic and USC professor Karen Tongson, and we did a tasting of the famed Filipino fast food chain Jollibee, which was extremely fun.
Mm, what is one standout dish from there?
I really love the noodle dish, the Palabok Fiesta, but their chicken is also fantastic. And then they make great fried pies a la McDonald's, but, you know, filled with mango or banana instead.
Mm. Locale, all of it, I'm sure.
Well, it's fast food. But delicious.
All right. Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food, Saturday mornings at 10 or wherever you get your podcasts. Evan, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Marcel Hutchins, and Nihar Patel. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Our technical director is Super Mario Saavedra. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you on Monday.